Hello and welcome to the Slow Home Podcast. This is the podcast all about slow living in a fast world. My name is Brooke McCallery.
And my name is Ben McCallery. And welcome to the fifth episode for our season, which is an ongoing season. It's the...
As seasons are.
It's turning. The season is turning. And
is that a reference
so
to the birds?
It is.
Nice.
Work. Nice work. In today's episode, you speak to a semi-regular guest on the podcast.
Definite friend
podcast,
of the show.
And that is Sarah Wilson.
I do.
So the two things that you guys have got in common at the moment is you're in lockdown and you're both writing a book.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
How's that going?
About as well as you could expect.
Do you talk about that at all?
Not so much. Sarah kind of gives a little bit of insight into the impact that the COVID 19 pandemic has had on her book writing, because she's a bit further ahead than I am and was like ready to hit go on sending the book to the printers and obviously has had to rework the book significantly. So we do talk about that a little
bit. That would be even more frustrating, I think.
Like I'm finding it difficult, as I think I've made quite clear over several episodes, but that would have been incredibly challenging, I think, because you get to the end of a huge project like that and you start to move forward into the new thing, the next thing, the space in between things even, and then to have to not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be really challenging. But that's not really the main thrust of the conversation.
No, like a lot of, well, all of your guests in this season, they're all bringing to the table some unique perspectives on what life is like in lockdown, and some good takeaways, practical takeaways that people can utilize. What does Sarah bring?
Sarah, as always, brings a very honest and open conversation. So one of the reasons that I wanted to have Sarah on was she's always been someone, A, who is willing to have an honest conversation. And I think that, as she and I talk about today, now is the time for honest conversations. Now is the time where we can investigate and excavate into the deeper parts of life, because there has not ever been a set of circumstances like this. But I also wanted to talk to her because of the work that she's done in highlighting and sharing her experience of anxiety. So First We Make the Beast Beautiful is truly one of the best books on anxiety that I've ever read.
Yep.
Very, very powerful. And I know that this is a time of great anxiety for a lot of people, maybe even people who haven't dealt with anxiety before. So that was kind of the reason for bringing her in. And we, of course, talk about that. But as always happens when I talk to Sarah, we end up in vastly different places
nice.
As well.
And that's the... That's where the golden nuggets come from, or the knowledge nuggets, I should say.
The knowledge nugs, damn. Yeah. So, you know, it's a really, I really enjoyed this conversation a lot, as I always do. And, yeah, I walked away from it feeling a really nice kind of energized and challenged in equal measure.
Nice.
Yeah. And, I mean, to give you a bit of context too, we kind of recorded this. So in Australia where – actually, I shouldn't say Australia. In New South Wales, the state that we live in, we are just about to start a gradual relaxation, I guess, of isolation rules.
Yeah, they're freeing up some of the – well, they're relaxing some of the restrictions around the lockup and isolation. So I think two adults are free to travel to see a relative and – there's a number of other sort of restrictions being lifted, and they're talking about it lifting even more restrictions in May. So
yeah. So that's just to kind of give context, because where Australia is at is vastly different to where other countries are at.
Absolutely. I read something today that Australia and New Zealand are best practice in terms of where the coronavirus is now and our response to that coronavirus. So I thought that was interesting. I think New Zealand's got an A+, and we've got an A.
Well, I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
Come on.
Totally.
It's New Zealand. I love New Zealand.
So head over to slowyourhome.com/season6 for the show notes to this podcast. You can see where you'll find links to Sarah's book, that you've just referenced and her social media and website?
Yeah. So sarahwilson.com is her home on the internet. Sarah is a prolific blogger as well. So head over. I mean, she and I kind of dig into some of what she's been writing about. And if any of that sounds like what you need in your life right now, go check her out at sarahwilson.com or on Instagram and all the various other places.
Awesome.
I hope you enjoy this conversation and I hope that you kind of walk away with a similar ratio of energized to challenged. Sarah's a one in a million. So
I like enjoy. That ratio. Enjoy.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
Oh, Brooke, I'm good.
You're good?
Yep, I am good. A solid 8 out of 10.
Well, that's a pretty good place to be. I think hitting eights is, you know, yeah I think that's a great place to be.
Even if I'm faking it just a little.
I feel like that's also a great place to be.
That's right. Yeah, until I make it, we'll just make this 8 out of 10.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for coming back on the podcast. I really appreciate you giving me some time to chat with you because, A, I just love talking to you, and B, I really wanted to pick your brain in the nicest possible way, given the circumstances so many of us find ourselves in. Now, you've written one of the best books on anxiety that I've ever read, and I know there is a huge number of us dealing with heightened levels of anxiety at the moment. So if it's okay with you, I'd love to start there.
Yep.
Awesome. Now, I guess, first of all, how are you traveling throughout the whole coronavirus situation, anxiety-wise and also more generally?
Okay, so generally I'm actually okay. I've been working from home and having to create my own business ventures and sources of income for about 10 years. And so I'm a little bit primed. I'm also, I've sort of done social isolation in various forms for many years. So, you know, and I've written the cookbook on Armageddon cooking, you know, and I sort of live, you know, I live for the apocalypse in an apocalyptic kind of manner. But so from that point of view, fine, not much changes for me. I don't have a life that requires buying things or owning things or some of the things I think that people are struggling with. In terms of anxiety, it's a specific type of anxiety. It's an interesting one. And, yes, there's sort of two things that I've noticed, and I've noticed it sort of with people who've got anxiety around me and, you know, people who read my blog posts and write to me each week. First thing is that I think people with kind of anxiety disorders as such, and for your listeners, I've got, you know, I've been diagnosed with bipolar for the last 25 years and I've got obsessive compulsive disorder. And really what I prefer to see it as is I've got heightened sensitivity. I'm an incredibly sensitive human, you know, mass of cells. And I sort of explore in First We Make the Beast Beautiful how there's an evolutionary purpose to that. 1.2 to 1.4% of the population has bipolar wherever you go in the world and throughout history. At least that's what they've estimated. And they've also found the same with obsessive compulsive disorder. At least with those two conditions, there's a certain percentage that exists. And so it's begged the question, well, does it exist for a purpose? And Brooke, I think I've shared this anecdote with you, but it's also in the book about Diane Fossey's work in Africa with disease. And she removed the overly sensitive types. The chimps that sat on the outskirts had no mates, were loners, but were awake all night and could hear the slightest sound, the slightest smell, and would alert the clan, the troop, whatever, to the danger. And, you know, they'd all flee very quickly. Now, when she removed those from the clan would die out within 6 months, and that happened time and time again. And so, you know, we've also looked throughout history, wartime leaders, crisis leaders, something like 70% were bipolar. I mean, that's a significant amount. Yeah. So, you know, if you think Winston Churchill, there's a whole host of them, as well as inventors and creators that, you know, created really incredible stuff during these times, particularly scientists. So Charles Darwin and, you know, artists obviously as well, they all produced massive amounts of really kind of important work during a crisis. So what I'm finding, just to get to my point, answer your question, is people with, you know, high, well, with disordered anxieties, you know, like the ones that psychiatrists can point a finger at, is that we are feeling almost a calmness, and it's quite surreal. It almost feels like we've arrived into our epoch, you know. And Greta Thunberg, she's commented on this with her Asperger's and also her anxiety. She's got all kinds of different phobias and so on. And, you know, as soon as she got involved in the climate movement, she just went, all of those things disappeared, yeah. And she was in her moment, in her flow. She'd arrived where she needed to be. And I really do think that people who are very anxious and have got these quirks, evolutionary quirks, at these times in history, we come to the fore because we're not berating ourselves for being kind of irrational, you know? Like, it's actually legit kind of fearful times. And so in that sense, I kind of feel like game on. I've got my full fight on. I'm ready to be of service, blah, blah, blah. Now, the problem is, and this is the second part of, you know, what I'm noticing about my anxiety and the anxiety of those around me, is that in a crisis, generally what we're programmed to want to do is to go and collectively get together with other humans, right? The problem together. And we are programmed just to go and hang out and pile on top of each other. So people who have got kids and people in their homes, it's been quite a enriching, albeit very difficult for some people, experience for those privileged enough to be able to be at home, don't have really huge financial woes perhaps, and are coping okay with the homeschooling. But even regardless of that, I think people are really enjoying the more connected times they're having. So for people like me who live on their own, socially isolated anyway, in part because of my, it is in part because of my mental conditions, we are denied that primitive urge to go and seek others. Very unusual circumstance. In a war, in any other crisis, we would be able to go and just, I don't know, get together collectively, work things out, sit in rooms, lead people through some complex thinking, and even just pile on top of each other on a couch when we need it, you know, at the end of the day. And we are literally, probably for a very rare moment in history, because in other pandemics, people didn't really live on their own. You know, they generally did live in households. There was far fewer single-person households. So, yeah, it's created a very specific type of anxiety. It's like a this-is-not-right-ness. And, Brooke, you and I, before we jumped on this podcast, we were just talking about it, how there's been virtually no discussion. In the last couple of days, I've noticed there's a little bit about the mental health component of what this is doing, and just the blindsidedness of leaders who are just talking about working families. I mean, Easter was a classic, right? I was really fretful about it. What was I going to do? I have no sense of belonging, and it's, you know, everybody's going to be sharing cute photos of their kids with bloody eggs and whatever. And, you know, our Prime Minister and various politicians come out and go, now, don't go away, don't go and, you know, don't move from the home. Spend Easter, you know, with your loved ones and enjoy your family. And I'm like, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I've been gobsmacked actually at the lack of conversation around the single person households, first of all, and what the impact that would be having on people's mental health, but also just the loneliness conversation. You know, like, we don't talk about loneliness generally anyway. There's some shame attached to it, but I wrote something a few weeks ago that referenced people who have woken up in their own households realizing that they're not going to be able to potentially see other loved ones for weeks, maybe months, and the devastation that must sort of bring to them. And I had a woman respond to me and said that was literally the first time she'd heard anyone reference it. And that really, really kicked me in the guts to feel that there is a significant proportion of society who are feeling completely ignored in all of this. You know, while, as you said, the conversation is all about how to, you know, work from home around your kids. And that's one set of challenges, but it's not the only set of challenges.
Well, I wrote a blog post about this, and I basically said, in a crisis, what's natural is to actually go and pile on top of each other, kind of chaos, and to just be with each other in a sort of a messy collective.
Yeah.
that is natural. What's not natural is to be sent off on your own to deal with the fear, the uncertainty, etc. on your own. And I went and looked into the science on this, and there's a fair bit of brain activity that goes on here. And we actually need eye contact and physical touch.
Yes.
To deal with the type of fear that comes from external threat. And we need it to be able to make sound judgments. So when we have the eye contact, the physical touch, our automated nervous system calms down enough so that we can then, I don't know, work out how we're going to fight the tiger, or, you know, deal with an army troop heading our way, or whatever it might be. So what I've been trying to say to people is, if you are on your own and you're anxious and you're just going spare, there is an evolutionary reason for it. We defied our own biology. But yeah, it's a really, I mean, I think that person who wrote back to you and said it's the first time they'd heard anyone say it, I've got to say I've not come across anyone who has proactively discussed this. And get it? Again, it's biological. Parents go into survival mode. So they are looking, we are programmed also to look after our next of kin, and pretty much at the exclusion of anyone else during a crisis. So we bunker down with our kids, our immediate clan, and really not a, and we become selfish. And so there's just almost an incapacity to think about others, which is a real concern, not just for the issue we're talking about, but I think it's a real concern more broadly when we start to discuss how we're going to have a better life out the other side of this and what life's going to look like. We need to actually break that selfish kind of patterning. Once we realise that, all right, we're all good, we're safe, the kids have got a system going with homeschooling and going back to school, okay, I've got my home, working from home routine, so now what?
Yes.
Now what am I going to do to actually get out of my selfish bubble? Because really, we're not under a great deal of threat, we've just got to stay home, here in Australia at least. I know overseas, a very different story. And also, of course, the economic factors in all of this will be the bigger issue.
Yep.
And that is very, very real. But for now, it's not like we've got a tiger. It's not like we've got bombs dropping, you know?
No, I think it offers us an opportunity. Like, you and I having this conversation is offering us an opportunity to step back and recognize, yes, our response is valid in kind of turning inwards and, you know, looking to protect. However, I think there's a lot of talk of developing stronger community through this. And I know that there are a lot of people who are doing things to make that happen, but talking about it is not going to be enough. And I'm not just talking about now either. I'm talking about what the other side is going to look like. And the optimist in me has hope that we can turn this around and use it as a pivot, I guess, in the way that society runs and the way that we look after each other and the way that we show up for each other. The pessimist in me is not quite so sure, but I'd like to think that there is enough people who are aware enough, who are thinking and finding themselves distinctly uncomfortable enough to push towards change. What do you think the overriding kind of desire is, I guess, as we push towards the other side?
Yeah, I'm grappling with that myself as well. I feel that there's been, so I come to this from a bit of a climate crisis perspective, because COVID-19 is a climate issue. It's been somewhat created by the climate dysfunction. It's been exacerbated certainly by it. And I think it will remain as a issue whatever the climate issue is so pertinent. And then, of course, it will also impact how we deal with climate change going forward. So it can't be separated. So for me, oh, look, I'm the same as you. People say to me, do you have hope? And I'm like, yep, I have hope, but I'm not optimistic. For me, hope is optimism with action. So for me, hope is not just going, oh, yeah, it'll all be good. Yeah, I reckon it'll be good. It's that with, all right, and how am I going to make it happen? So, yeah, hope is far more active than optimism. I think that we need to actually shift some of the messaging and as I say, if we talk climate, the climate movement, towards a few things that are different to the way we've been doing it previously. And I think we need to start talking about things in terms of, all right, so remember that lovely feeling of solidarity you felt during the pandemic and the isolation period? Okay, let's harness that, you know. And I think the solidarity piece is going to be a really good one to actually feed off and to get people to remember it. I totally agree with you. This is an opportunity. We can go one way or the other.
Yeah.
My fear is in Australia. I know you've got listeners around the world, but for anyone overseas listening, Australia has had at this stage, while, you know, I think there's over 50,000 deaths in the US, we've had 90. And I think something like close to 30 of them have been in a handful of old people's, you know, old people's homes.
Nursing homes, yeah.
And so we've really got off it very, very lightly. And I think there's a bunch of reasons for that. So it's kind of interesting. We might come out of this with the classic Australian she'll be right kind of mentality once again, right?
Like, yeah, oh, absolutely.
It's going to be really bad. Now, I think the economic situation will certainly will be hard. I think it'll be quite universal in terms of the world shifting in that respect. And I don't think we've even begun to see the beginning of it. And I think that's going to be a very big disruptor. But it remains to be seen whether we use this as a wake-up call. Now, the Australian bushfires that, you know, really changed and they affected you, obviously, Brooke, and I'm sure many people listening are aware of that, that didn't shift the dial, and we all thought it would.
Yeah.
There's been a number of polls done that show that it just didn't, it really not in a major way. And so, yeah, we as humans tend to go back to the sort of the default very, very quickly. And I suppose it just depends on how long and how hard this gets.
Yeah, and that's sort of it's a strange thing to be talking about this in real time, because I'm very aware that we don't know what the future holds. But I think Australians are particularly adept at kind of just shifting back into the old normal. Yeah, the she'll be right kind of attitude. And sort of it felt almost like that once the fires were extinguished with that huge rain that we had in late January, early Feb. You know, it was like this sigh of relief, of course, but also just this, okay, now we can get back to some semblance of normal. I mean, of course, forgetting that however many thousands of homes were destroyed and people lost their lives and all that sort of stuff, Australians are still very good at snapping back to that, she'll be right. And I worry that this will be more of a blip on the year. And I say that with respect for the pain that it's brought people. But in the grand scheme, I can see how that might be definitely the point of view of a significant proportion of people, you know, and that worries me.
That's right. I don't think we should apologize for this, because I think in terms of saying, oh, it might just be a blip and people will be going through financial hardship, we can acknowledge both. And I think the financial hardship is going to be huge. You know, the figures already internationally are really pointing out a pretty dire setup. Yeah, I think Australians could still go back to it. Now, the other thing about Australia is that we are the only OECD country that didn't go through a recession during global financial crisis, sort of, you know, 2008, 2009. And so we just have managed to sort of scrape out of the global kind of disasters one after another. Like, it gets a little bit bad and then we go back to the default. Look, it looks like that could be happening again, but I do think that the financial side of things are going to hit us, and it's going to hit the millennials really, really hard. And so, you know, that's going to be a major corrector. It's going to be a rude shock. And I think, you know, for anyone listening who is an activist, who is concerned, like, you know, you and I are, Brooke, I think one thing that we probably need to be aware of is it'll probably take some time for the shock and fear and all the overwhelm to pass. Mm-hmm. And probably where we can be of service is to talk through those emotions and have conversations like this with each other, where we discuss these things, so that, for instance, the millennials, who literally have not had an economic downturn in their entire life, and it's all very, very new, and they were promised the world and now they've hit rock bottom, I think we can actually work to ensuring they don't go into overwhelm and panic, but instead go, right, game on, let's fight this, let's create something new. And that was the atmosphere before the last sort of, you know, the early 90s recession. So that was the last time we had a recession. I came out of university. I think I'm a bit older than you, Brooke, but I came out in 1991, 92, and there were no jobs. It was, you know, it was like close to 20% unemployment for young people. It's roughly what where things are at today. And it was grim, you know, really grim. And it was the recession we had to have, you know, that one. So, you know, in hindsight, I go, yeah, wasn't far wrong. But what it did was my generation became, well, probably the last generation until recently to be quite activist, to be anti-capitalist. We were all, you know, you didn't wear branded stuff. We were anti, you know, Nike. We were actually discussing big ideas and being quite worked up about things. And it was really in the early 90s that it started to shift towards that opulent mentality where you start to get a bit kind of blasé and she'll be right and let's just earn more and more money and eat more and more food and just more, more, more.
Yeah.
So I think an economic recession is going to be the best, and I use that word really, really kind of self-consciously, the best trigger, the most effective trigger to create the change that we are really hoping for at our cause. And it's a shame that that's the way, but that's, I think it was Milton Friedman, you know, one of the founders of contemporary capitalism, said that the only thing that creates change is a crisis, and it depends on the ideas that are lying around at the time. And,
right.
Yeah, we don't have great ideas lying around at the moment. We've got to be aware of that. So what are we going to do about it? We've got to start talking better ideas. We might as well do it now.
And I think that that is actually the key thing. Like, you made two points that really stuck out to me, which is we need to give ourselves the opportunity and the permission, I guess, to have these conversations, these sort of messy human conversations where we're trying to work out what feels like a positive, exciting way forward, and do that without like cancel culture coming in and shutting it down, you know, because there is that element too. If people are having these big conversations and tossing around these big ideas, like I find myself constantly sort of qualifying what I'm saying in the hopes that I don't offend anyone. And that's not where creativity and connections, like dots, are going to be joined in that sense of fear. So allowing ourselves and kind of being stewards, I guess, of that permission giving is a really important thing for people like you and I to do.
Yeah.
But also the second point I think that really struck me is that certainly in my life, and I know in a lot of other people's lives, very rarely does change grow out of anything other than discomfort, you know, and if this is not uncomfortable, then I don't know what is this whole situation.
Right. And the thing is, we've also become a generation, a culture, a demographic, a world that is really uncomfortable with discomfort.
Yes.
We don't have to wait for anything. We don't have to delay gratification. We don't have to sit in the unknown. I've said this a few times recently. I mean, we don't even have to wonder how long our takeaway pizza is going to be.
Right. So
the little dot on the Deliveroo or the Uber Eats app, like we know exactly when it, like there's no sense of that, that sort of, being that chasm of discomfort, which is what human life is about. And, you know, I've spoken about this in the context of young people a few times recently. And we have created a generation that are protected and cocooned from everything except for real life. So, and which, of course, when real life strikes, and God, shit can't get more real than it is right now, you know, we're not equipped. We're just not equipped. And I think that's a really interesting thing and a really important thing for everyone to bear in mind is that we are sort of, it's like we're the really unfit person who has to go and do an ultra marathon tomorrow. Like that's where we're at. We don't have any resilient muscle. And we've got to be a little bit understanding of that, acknowledge it. It's not a good thing to, like it's not a pretty thing to acknowledge. Like it's kind of, you know, it's a bit shameful, like that we have no capacity for dealing with this kind of stuff. And we don't have leaders who can talk this language. I mean, you know, New Zealand's leader has been wonderful. Jacinda Ardern has done an incredible job of talking through the emotional side of things, you know, throughout all of this. And I think that that's really made a difference. It's actually brought people up to speed in terms of their emotional resilience. But, yeah, we don't have these conversations. We don't have moral leaders. We don't have spiritual leaders. We don't have wise elders, you know.
No, we don't, and we don't give space for them to emerge either, I don't think. You know, I think there is a yearning for it, but I don't necessarily think we offer the room for it to expand into. You were talking about convenience, you know, essentially as the thing, one of the things that has really removed the idea of delayed gratification from our lives, which in itself is kind of adding to this lack of resilience and this lack of any kind of capability of dealing with discomfort. And one of the things that I have noticed, and I even have conflicted thoughts about this, but one of the things I've noticed in sort of isolation is that there has been an uptick in people doing things that take time. They're not convenient. So I'm like thinking about things like baking sourdough or, you know, starting a vegetable garden. And I think that there is a certain element of keeping up with the isolation Joneses happening there, you know, like my sourdough was crispier than, you know, than yours. I do really like that there is this at least conversation and this experimentation with people happening into things that take longer. As someone who has learned how to grow a vegetable garden over the last 10 years, that's one of the biggest takeaways for me, is that things take time and you need to keep turning up and snails are going to eat your seedlings and like things are going to really piss you off and it's going to be hot and it's going to rain a lot. And it's taught me how to just be and accept things for being uncomfortable and for being a bit crap.
Absolutely. I mean, nature in general is one of our best teachers because it takes us to where the flow of life is at, whether you like it or not. So, you know, anything that engages you in nature and you're not trying to dominate it is wonderful for that. But, yeah, I think that's a really great observation as, you know, slow expert, that people are appreciating slow. And it's one layer deeper than that. It's kind of attuning ourselves with the actual rhythm of life.
Yeah.
And the slow is one word, but just steady and methodical and present are sort of good words too. Yeah, it's interesting. But of course, one thing we keep apologizing for some of the language and ideas that we share. But one thing that I'm conscious about is there's a very substantial sector of the community who are not getting access to this. And I know this because I've just had to rewrite my most recent book, which was meant to go to the printer 2 days before COVID struck. And I had to stall it and then rewrite the friggin' book to incorporate, you know, what is now a very dramatically changed world. I've been up until sort of end of last week completely busy working from 5 a.m. till late at night to get this thing done. And I certainly, you know, I see these people on Instagram doing all these languid activities like your sourdoughs and so on, banana bread being the other one. And, you know, just we're all in it together. We're all just at home chilling out. And I'm like, yeah, all right, some of us are. But some of us still work in industries where we are expected to keep working. Then there's the people who are the frontline workers, as well as the really disenfranchised. And we don't see it quite so much in Australia, but it certainly is present. And it's coming out of the undergrowth, right? So the Uber, you know, the Uber riders, the supermarket people who are at risk, they're at the front line. Yeah. And, of course, nurses and so on. Although, you know, here they haven't had much work because we haven't had enough illnesses or you know, people affected by the pandemic in that way. But, there is a real divide now. And I think that's something that's got to be recognised. The most vocal, i.e. people on social media, and, you know, they're sharing stories of, you know, oh, this is so great. We're going back to basics. It's a great equalizer. It's like, no, it's
no
exposure, exposing agent of just how unfair this world is, you know? And that's another discussion we need to have. Who are the essential workers now? Oh,
exactly.
The most underpaid, underprivileged, disenfranchised people on the planet. Nurses, teachers, you know, so delivery people, part-time, disenfranchised, you know, I mean, and we're talking migrants, women, that's something that, yeah, I think we've really got to be aware of. So the slow thing, I think, is actually a wonderful privilege that some of us have had access to. And those of you who are listening who do have access to it, please enjoy it. Please don't feel guilty. Please do slow. Please access this space as a collective, and then also be aware of what's happening in the rest of the world. Apply some of that sort of considered approach to life to watching the news and reading really good media outlets so that we can be aware of these things and be engaged and be truly, you know, engaged in solidarity in the world that faces us afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you, particularly about the idea that all of this slow time is an enormous privilege. But I think also what is key is, A, don't take that and use it as a stick to beat yourself up with, but take the opportunity that you have to be a little more spacious and to use that time and energy to dig in and question, what can I do to make things different and more equitable and fairer and more just and more sustainable on the other side? Like, that's how this won't be easily forgotten, is if we use where we're at. You know, my yoga teacher once told me, she's like, don't feel bad about taking time to care for yourself, because it's only when you do that that you can turn around and care for others. And I think that this is sort of an example of that. Those of us who are privileged enough, and I the way I explain privilege to myself is that it is opportunity, you know, and privilege essentially is access to things. And we have the privilege and the opportunity, so let's use it. And, you know, that's how we move forward and make space for others at the table.
Yeah, I get asked about this a bit, and how do we sort of become a little more engaged and so on. And people don't like the answer, unfortunately. And it's worth thinking about, well, why don't we like the answer? The answer is to actually, like I said before, get political, get activist, read the news, actually learn what's happening out in the world. And even though it's uncomfortable and it's painful to watch, don't turn away. And I remember in the bushfires, I wrote a Instagram post that said, you know, the best thing we can do right now for those of us who are not right there in the fires is to not turn away. Don't turn away from the discussions around climate and around the politics, because the political situation was really dire. It was happening so badly. Don't turn away. The best thing we can do is be engaged with our, you know, our fellow Australians who are at the front line in whatever it is that they're going through, so that when it comes to the table as a policy decision or an election, we're armed. We are truly coming together in solidarity. We're not just voting for our own hip pocket. And I have this kind of discussion, I suppose. I was going to say argument, but it's not quite that, because it wouldn't go down well in the spiritual community. But I say to, you know, sort of people who are, you know, meditators and yogis and so on, the spiritual is political. It always was. Jesus was political. Gandhi was political. Like, that's how spiritual movements got off the ground in the first place, is during times of political upheaval. And, you know, we needed radical thinkers who could take us to a new level of engagement with the planet. And we're at that moment now. We need to be spiritual and political. You know, we need to be slow and we need to be outraged. And that's something that, you know, we live in such a polarized culture where it's either black or white. No, we're going to do both.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Black and white isn't going to cut it, you know. And I think, as we said earlier, having these messy conversations and digging in and getting radical in our thoughts and ideas and allowing ourselves to do that is vital in making space for those conversations and those ideas. And I love what you just said. We need to be slow and we need to be outraged, you know. And I guess that's a really interesting point. Like, a lot of people will say to me that they have to turn off the news. They no longer get that information from those media sources because it's having a negative impact on their mental health. Where do you sit with that?
Yeah, I get annoyed with that. I'm going to be really honest, and some listeners might get annoyed with me, but hey, let's have different opinions. I think that, yeah, I mean, I don't love watching the news, but I feel that it's a responsibility at the moment, in particular at the moment. And yes, you've got to put up boundaries. So, you know, you don't just have your Twitter feed coming through all day on your screen and you become lost to the news cycle. It is about, you know, so my practice, it's a practice. I treat it almost like I do meditation or a morning routine or whatever it is. I listen to Radio National in the morning for about an hour as I'm going about getting myself, you know, going through the practicalities of my morning. And I love it. It's considered. It has both opinion and sort of experts. And I get a very good rounded view, and especially in the mornings, because they do these great wrap-ups of big issues where you hear the very detailed stuff going on around the world. And The other thing is, it shouldn't just be parochially about our, because we live in a global pandemic. This is a global issue. And then I then read the New York Times and the Guardian and the New Yorker, and I happen to read probably a little bit more than maybe other people would want to, but I think some, you know, staying abreast of one of these publications and especially their op-ed pages, you get some really great detailed rundowns. And then in the evening I watch the 7 p.m. ABC Bulletin and 7:30 Report. And then I also try to sort of do a bit of the mainstream media as well. And I sort of access that through Facebook. I'll sort of see what's happening in other media. We just have to, it's hard work. Yes, it can trigger outrage. It can trigger fear. But, hey, we're adults and we're going to have to be fully adult right now. I kind of go, yeah, it's kind of upsetting and everything. And, and are you a snowflake or are you an adult with responsibilities? So, yeah, and look, we all have our threshold, but what I would say is if everyone can actually get a little bit more engaged, it'll actually augur very well for us when we come out of this.
Well, as you said, it arms us with information to then make decisions that are aligned with our values.
Those who are feeling that they get overwhelmed by the news, so therefore I just don't watch the news. No, I'm not into politics. They're also the people that say, I'm just so overwhelmed, I don't know what to do, I feel helpless, I feel like I'm powerless. They'll often be the same people. And it's like, all right, well, step one is to be engaged in these issues, and then you start to see paths forward, and then you start to open up to groups who are activating in a certain area. Engagement is one of the best ways to combat overwhelm and powerlessness. Action begets action. And, you know, I looked into this in my next book. Lots of science that just shows by getting involved, learning about things, it actually abates a huge amount of anxiety.
I think that's actually a really good point to finish on, because I know as we opened that there is a huge amount of people listening who are feeling highly anxious at the moment. And also so many of the same people are questioning, what is this new normal going to look like? What can I do to ensure that it is a better normal than the one that we're leaving behind? Action, engagement and action, you know, learning, listening, taking on board information and then discerning it and making decisions based on your values and then acting, you know, that's really the way forward.
Yeah, it's both the practical solution but also the emotional, personal solution.
Yeah.
For dealing with the pain that we're experiencing personally. And I don't say that as a way to try to get you all to, you know, sign, get up petitions and all of that kind of thing. I say it as somebody who I've found it is the most effective way for me to deal with my anxiety at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's really powerful. Sarah, thank you so much for another really thought-provoking conversation. They always are with you.
Forever, Brooke, to be honest.
it was awesome. I genuinely appreciate you being so open and honest as well. It's
it's the time for it, isn't it?
It is, and you're leading the way, so thank you.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.